I want to continue on the series that I've been covering when I'm here, which is in the Pali word of the series is called the Lokottara Nidana. And Nidana means something like the conditions, the supporting conditions for something, the causal, not simply causal, but the supporting conditions. And Lokottara means the supermundane. Supermundane in this case means that which pertains to the awakening, the liberation, when the mind, the awareness, the heart is no longer constrained or limited by anything that belongs to the world of conventions, the normal conventions we mostly live in, the concepts and conventions. And the Lokottara Nidana is one of the number of different ways of describing kind of the path for attaining this unconventional liberation that Buddhism points towards. And it's a kind of 12 supporting conditions. One condition supports the other condition, supports the other. And the final condition pretty much is the liberation and the fruits of liberation. And so it begins with suffering, which we've talked about a fair amount now. In Buddhism, the understanding is most people or everyone begins their practice trying to grapple or come to terms with some level of suffering or dissatisfaction. And then there's faith. And then there's delight and joy. And then there's tranquility or calmness. And based on, supported by calmness and tranquility is happiness. And then happiness then becomes support for the subject of today, which is concentration. And concentration is a topic which is very important. It's a topic which is hopefully interesting. We'll see how we go along here, how interesting I make it. And also, concentration is a theme or a topic which causes a lot of people a lot of distress, because concentration is usually something that's talked about as something you develop. Can you hear me okay? People are moving over toward the speaker.
See?
It's too high. Muffled. If I lower it like that, is that better? Not better. Oh, that's the wrong one. No. So if I lower it like that, is that better? No, if I had it closer to... Right up. So is that better now? Is it clear or still muffled or a little bit better?
I think the muffling may have to do with that it requires a lot of concentration.
On my part, to talk clearly. I could also try not using it and speaking louder. Is that clear if I speak louder?
Yeah.
Should we try today and see if I can sustain it? Okay. So the topic of concentration is also one that causes a lot of can cause distress for people, because in that it's something that's usually understood to be something we cultivate or attain, then people will huff and puff and try to attain it and measure their success at, you know, make any more concentrated or less concentrated, and usually feel like they're not getting concentrated enough or not getting concentrated at all, and the mind is just crazy, and you can't seem to attain it or get it under control. And so then people feel really disappointed in themselves. You know, you're supposed to get concentrated. I'm not getting concentrated, so therefore it's hopeless. And, you know, I'll take up mountain hiking. So, concentration. Well, I'll start then with a story on concentration that will kind of create maybe hopefully a little balance to the idea that concentration is the only thing that's important, which some people think when they think of meditation. And this is a story of, or maybe a tale, of a young man in Japan who was inherited a lot of money. And it was kind of a dilettante, kind of just squandered his money, going to, spending a lot of time drinking and playing Go, which is Chinese chess. And he just kind of went further and further down into some kind of pit of disillusionment, discouragement. He spent all his money and lived in broke and hadn't developed no skills and never gone to school really and developed anything, no job, career, no prospectus, and things seemed pretty hopeless for him. So one of the few wonderful alternatives in Japan to being integrated into normal society is to go to a Buddhist temple, the monastery, because it's understood in Japan that in some sense Buddhist monasteries or temples are outside of the normal conventions of Japanese society. If you choose to go off and become a monk or a nun, you in some way sever your connection to the normal ways of participating in society in Japan. So he'd already kind of severed those connections, so he went to a monastery, and to a famous Zen monastery where he went and saw the famous abbot. And he described his condition and said, you know, I'm basically been a dilettante and I squandered all this money. I spend most of my days in a drunken stupor. And I'm good for nothing. I can't accomplish anything. And I think that I should just give up my life. But I'm here. If you can tell me how to get enlightened, I'll do whatever it takes. And the abbot asked him, well, what are you good at? And he said, I'm not good at anything. I never developed any abilities. And the abbot said, oh, certainly you must be good at something. Everyone's good at least one thing. So finally he said, well, I can play a pretty good game of Go, this Japanese chess. So the abbot said, great. And he called his most senior monk in the monastery, who had been in the monastery for many, many years, many decades, and called him and said, go to the storage closet and get out the Go table, the Go board, and get out my sword. He had a very sharp samurai sword. And so the senior monk went and got these things. And he said, so he gave it to the abbot, and he placed it between the young man and the senior monk. And he said, okay, I want the two of you to play Go. And this particular game of Go is very consequential. Because the person who loses the game, I'm going to cut off their head with my sword. So he laid the sword down in front of him. And so these two started playing. The young man, because this is what the abbot was telling him to do, he'd given up all other hope, and this seemed to be the only kind of step forward. And the old monk, because he was quite obedient, it was his teacher, his abbot, who was asking him to do this, and so he was going to play a game. So the game went quite intensely, you can imagine, with those kinds of stakes. And so much so that the young man in particular broke out into a sweat and was quite absorbed in the game. And for a while it looked like the old monk was going to win. And then after a while, it shifted. So the advantage was in the hands of the young man. And it looked like he was going to win. And when it looked like he was going to win, he finally kind of broke his absorption for a moment and looked up at the old monk who was facing him, his opponent. And he saw the old monk, and he saw these years and years, decades of deep spiritual sincerity, deep spiritual endeavor, deep peace and calm, and something he had never really encountered in anyone else before. And he was so moved by looking into the eyes, into the face of this old monk, that moved by compassion, moved by care and connectedness, that he then made a couple of mistakes on the board intentionally, because he didn't want the old monk to die. And so he started, the young man kind of played in such a way that he lost, or it looked like he was going to lose, and it was pretty clear that the old monk was going to win. And at that point the abbot, who was watching this with his sword in front of him, leaned forward and threw the go board up in the air and said, no one wins, no one loses. And then he turned to the young man and said, there are two really important qualities that you need to have if you're going to become enlightened or practice sincerely in this monastery. One is concentration. You seem to have ample ability for concentration. And the other is you need compassion. And now you've discovered compassion. Now you're ready. So, for those of you who find concentration to be somewhat frustrating, cultivate your compassion instead. Compassion is also a very important quality. You need to have both of them. But concentration is something which can bring a tremendous amount of delight and joy in a spiritual practice. Many people who are very deeply adepts in various spiritual practices might not talk about concentration as being a factor of mind which is present for them. But I think many of the great mystics, the Christian mystics, where they're kind of absorbed, you know, in contemplations of God, or absorbed in their visions of God, or absorbed in the Godhead, or whatever the expression was, it's often one of the primary ways of that has been through tremendous love for God, and that they kind of absorb that love. Provides the concentration, they can completely absorb. And nothing else exists for them in their consciousness. The mind is not divided or distracted by other kinds of forces and factors. But they're wholly involved with their object of love, which is God. And it's quite wonderful, that experience. It might be a lot easier to get fully absorbed and concentrated when you can have a personal relationship to a deity. Because, you know, it's kind of personal then, right? Buddhists don't have that advantage. What? Oh, it can be quite wonderful to have. It can be quite easy to get absorbed in a concentrated way when the object of a concentration is a god with whom you can have a personal relationship. If we have a personal relationship with something, we often get much more interested. Buddhists don't have this advantage. Because we don't develop a personal relationship with another being like a god, so it's some of the motivations that get concentrated might be lacking. However, concentration is still a very important factor, and we have to find other resources inside of ourselves for developing that kind of full absorption or full involvement with our practice. So concentration. It said the word here in these 12 steps is samadhi, and samadhi is one of the words often translated as concentration. But samadhi also means samadhi has a little more particular meaning than simply concentration. There's a word, another word, which is quite common in Buddhist psychology, which in Pali is ekagata. Ekagata literally means one-pointedness, to be one-pointed. And everyone has the ability to become one-pointed. In Buddhist psychology, they teach that actually every moment of consciousness, there's an element of one-pointedness in that moment of consciousness. And now, what happens for many people when they think they're scattered in their mind is that they're one-pointed serially on many varied things. So the mind is very quickly kind of going around. But in each particular instant of the mind, it has one pointedness only to focus on what's going on. Samadhi is arises when one is absorbed or has some kind of continuous absorption into, over time, in what one is paying attention to. So mind is not scattered in many different points. I think the way most of us experience our conventional minds is we actually have many points where the mind is going. We're fragmented and scattered with our attention. If we're doing two or three things at once, then in our conventional sense of it, the mind is kind of pointed in various directions at the same time. And one pointedness of samadhi is when there becomes only one point of the mind. The whole mind is, the whole mind, the whole awareness, the whole being is harmonized and unified together on and continuously through time on basically on one event or one subject, one approach, one thing that's happening in the present moment. And this is what we're trying to, part of one of the things we're trying to develop in Buddhist practice, is this ability to harmonize all our faculties, unifying all our faculties. Another word is to integrate all our different faculties. So all our faculties are operating harmoniously and directed at the same event. So they're all kind of working together. As I often say, especially in the introductory course, if you sit down to meditate and you place your body here, and once you close your eyes, you start thinking about what happened at work yesterday, then your mind and your body are in two different places. And the idea is to bring your mind and the body together in the same place at the same time. Which can only, since your body is only in the present moment all the time, in order to bring, you can't bring your body to the future. At least not, you know, not, maybe in Star Trek you can, but we don't bring our body into the future or bring our body into the past. Really, it's the task of the mind to bring itself into the same place as the body, here and now. So we have to find some real interest and delight and value in bringing the mind, bringing our awareness into the same place where our body is. In the body, with the body, in this place, at this time. And there's a third factor that gets integrated, and that is our intention. There's the awareness, there's the body, and our intention has to be harmonized with those two. There has to be kind of an intention to be engaged in what we're paying attention to in the present moment. So these things are working together. The body, the mind, the awareness, and our intention, our motivation. Our motivation, we're not sitting here wishing, you know, that we're doing something else. Or, you know, or starting to plan some wonderful, you know, project that we might want to do. So everything is coming to bear, integrated, harmonized is the word, concentration. Now, so the word is samadhi, which is a very rich word in Buddhism. It has many different meanings. Am I still speaking loud enough? And it has many different meanings, and it has many different references. But something which Buddhists will talk about a lot, because it's a very valuable part of spiritual practice, to enter into samadhi, to have a samadhi. In the Eightfold Path, the Buddha taught. The eighth element of the path is Samma Samadhi, which can be translated to English as right samadhi or proper samadhi, as opposed to inappropriate samadhi or wrong samadhi. And this is pointing to the fact that you can get very concentrated, your mind can get very absorbed on something unwholesome, something unhealthy. Someone who really wants to do some horrible crime might develop tremendous concentration in order to do that climb. Someone who wants to take advantage of someone might develop tremendous concentration in taking advantage of that person. There's a lot of unwholesome activities that we can do. If you can go to war and want to kill people, there's tremendous concentration in that action that gets developed. So we're not talking about any kind of concentration. In Buddhism, we want to cultivate what's called Samma Samadhi, right concentration, which involves focusing the mind in a wholesome way and focusing on for a wholesome purpose, for a healthy purpose. And usually then we choose something which is a healthier, wholesome focus for our attention. So most classically, one of the ways we develop concentration is focusing on the breath. There's many different ways of developing it, but focusing on the breath is one way. Now focusing on the breath, it isn't just simply the object which is important, but also the way in which we engage in that object of attention, which is important. And this is where it gets really tricky and very important. Some people who try to develop concentration will try to do a kind of frontal assault on concentration, as if they're going to act of will. They're going to sit down and then close their eyes, and they expect and demand that, okay, I'm going to sit here, I'm going to get concentrated today, and I'm just going to zero in on my breath and zero in on my attention and get absorbed. And Occasionally, through a tremendous act of will, it can work that way. But if it's through greed, or through ambition, or through trying to augment or build up a sense of self to be the most concentrated person on the block and show off, then it's not sama samadhi, it's not right concentration, and it's tinged with something unwholesome, and it prevents the mind from actually going into the levels of purity, purification that comes with deep states of concentration. So it's not exactly an act of will, but it's not actually something we... Concentration can occur by accident, which happens to many people when they meditate. Many take credit for it. But it's just all the conditions that come together just right. It's interesting that concentration in these 12 supportive steps for liberation is a sixth step, which implies to me that there's all this preparatory work of bringing supporting conditions together to make it easier for concentration to flourish. Just like you compare this wonderful composted, fertilized flower bed, and then you plant your seed in there, and the seed might grow. But if the seed begins growing and you start pulling on the seedling to see how it's growing, pull it up and look at how the roots are doing, and then put it back in again, it doesn't really grow. There has to be a creation of an environment for which concentration can grow. And then we place the seed of practice, and then we support and nourish that seed, but we don't, you know, we're not actively pulling on the seedling to make it grow longer and bigger. There's something about developing a concentration which has a quality of being impersonal, or being, almost like a gift, or an act of grace, or something. We certainly have to do add our contribution to the practice of becoming concentrated. We have to do our piece. But when I get concentrated, I don't take credit for it. I don't feel like I'm the one who did it. Does that make sense? So I mean, this wonderful story of the movie some years ago of was it called Field of Dreams? And the mantra of the movie is, build it and he will come. It's kind of like that with meditation. You have to build something. You have to contribute something. And then something will come. And the concentration is something we also have to allow to come. There's a sense of allowing it. But we have to create the conditions for it to make it possible. So for example, you're not going to get very concentrated in a normal meditative career, sitting every day and going on retreats, if it isn't some sense of continuous practice. If you don't sit every day, then you don't have any of the conditions that allow that deeper kind of allowing or cultivation or surfacing, a flowering of concentration to occur. So you have to contribute the condition of continuity. If you don't have continuity, then it's very hard to get concentrated. There has to be a sense of carefulness, of care with one's life, so that one's life is not in conflict with the values of a deeply sensitive and calm and peaceful heart. If we live a life which is filled with busyness all the time, or filled with ambition, filled with lust, filled with hate, filled with harming other people, that's not creating the right compost that allows a seed of concentration, the seed of awakening to grow. So we have to take care of our ethics, and take care of our speech, to create the right conditions. Many people need to simplify their lives. Simplification is one of the great ways of cultivating concentration. One of the ways to simplify life is not to get rid of anything, but to do only one thing at a time. Doing only one thing at a time is phenomenally supportive for the cultivation of concentration. If you're doing a number of different things at a time, including listening to the radio and driving, it's a wonderful thing to do sometimes. But it's not, you know, I'm not saying that it's wrong to do that, but when you do that, chances are you're not supporting the right conditions for a mind which is deeply settled on one thing, which is what samadhi is a lot about. So one of the stories about concentration that was very important for the Buddha was after his 6 years of ascetic practices, in ancient India. Well, he was considered to be the greatest ascetic of his times. He felt discouraged. He hadn't really made any progress in the way he wanted to. And so he felt discouraged. And I guess he was about to give up his ascetic life, his spiritual life. And then he remembered an event that happened to him when he was 6 years old. And this event was, it was a spring day, maybe like today, and in the foothills of the Himalayas where he lived, they were going to have the spring plowing festival, the first plowing of the spring. And all the villagers, all the people, and his father and family, were all out in the fields. And they had forgotten, weren't giving any notice to the little baby Buddha, kid Buddha, who was left on the edge of the field underneath the rose apple tree, in the shade of the tree. And sitting there, very quietly, left alone, sitting upright, without a care in the world, comfortable conditions, he entered into a deep state of samadhi. He entered into deep states of joyful concentration. He just kind of, all his different faculties became unified and whole, and he became unconflicted with himself, unconflicted with the world, and completely contented and happy to be here right now in the present moment. And entered into kind of a samadhi of joy. And then sometimes some kids have this kind of experience, and it's kind of useful sometimes to remember some of the holistic feelings we've had sometimes as children. He had this experience, and then 30 years later, he remembered this event. And he thought to himself something like this. The ascetic practice is not working. I've tried all the different practices that existed for me in my time, and none of them seems to work. But this wonderful experience when I was a child, maybe there's some key to that, maybe that about how to proceed in my spiritual practice. And he remembered at that time he was removed or separated or not involved with any sensual pleasures, any pleasures of the senses. His mind was removed or separated temporarily from any kind of unwholesome motivations or activity. There was no aversion in the mind acting, no hate. There was no desire, no clinging towards anything. There was no doubt. There was no restlessness. There was none of the various kinds of ways in which our mind can get unwholesome. And you know, maybe this is the way. If I just allow myself... Oh, the other thing was that this experience as a child had a kind of spontaneous quality to it. He wasn't trying to make it happen. He was just sitting there, and it kind of happened to him. It kind of flowered within him, in a sense. So that maybe this is the way to go forward, is to remove myself from my involvement with sensual pleasures, is to remove myself, at least temporarily, from my involvement with any kind of unwholesome movements of mind or activities of mind, and allow myself to get concentrated with that as a condition. And there's a feeling of kind of spontaneity. It's kind of like, it arises almost when we create the right conditions. Those conditions are in place. For a lot of people, one of the primary things we have to learn in our mindfulness practice is to learn how not to be seduced by our desire for comfort or sensual pleasure, which is a tremendously powerful force in people's lives. Not that those things are wrong or bad, we need to avoid them in all places, but if meditators are being motivated by pursuit of sensual pleasures, to have sensual pleasures as they meditate, then they can't go to the next level, deeper level of concentration. And we also have to learn to identify really clearly the forces of unwholesome movements in the mind. We have to become experts at understanding, for example, the five hindrances. You have to become real experts and notice how the mind gets involved in desires, in aversions, in restlessness, in boredom and sloth and lethargy, and in doubt. Become real experts at these things so that we don't get seduced by them, we don't get caught by them when they arise. These things will arise in your mind, it's quite normal. But usually we get on board, we get involved with them, we get entangled with them. As mindfulness develops it's essential that a person begins to see how we get entangled in these things when they arise in the mind, so we can learn not to get entangled. And the ability not to get entangled in these forces when they arise is part of the conditioning that supports the arising of concentration. So concentration. So there's something about gift-like to it. There's something about, at least in my experience of it, that I don't feel anymore that I'm responsible for it, or that I'm creating it or making it happen. Even if I'm focusing on just one thing like a breath, and in that focus and in that concentration of the breath, somehow the concentration develops, I don't actually feel like I'm taking credit for it. I can't take credit for it. It's kind of like this. It's kind of like my placing my attention on the breathing is kind of a conventional understanding of concentration. I could keep it there to some degree. I can make an effort to keep it there. But samadhi is not just simply the willful or the gentle keeping the attention on the breath. Samadhi is when the rest of the being begins to settle itself around that object of attention, or the rest of our whole being begins to harmonize itself and bring itself along to focus on that. When the whole, it's kind of like a feeling almost of the whole body begins to be suffused with a sense of presence, with a sense of maybe joy or tingling or delight. And that whole sense of unified embodied presence kind of all seems to be supporting focusing on the breath or focusing on what you're looking at. So samadhi is much more than just simply this narrow kind of ability of our mind to kind of focus on something. It's the sense of absorption, totally embodied absorption, that seems to arise on its own when all the conditions are there, including the condition that we're kind of keeping our attention focused. Is that making sense? I'm talking about this. Now, in these 12 steps of the supermundane path, remember that concentration arises after happiness. That a happy mind is one that can become concentrated, and a concentrated mind is one that's happy. So again, it's very helpful to think of that we don't want to just do a frontal assault on concentration, which many Western meditators think they're supposed to do. But it's very important to think about how can I create conditions in my life that are supportive of a spiritual life. Are there ways in which I can become happier? Are there ways in which I can feel delight or feel some calmness and tranquility? And there are many ways we can change our lives to do that. There's sometimes a tendency in the West to think that we can have it all. So that, you know, we'll just sprinkle a little bit of spirituality on top of, you know, everything else that we do, thinking that we can just, you know, barrel ahead and get everything. But I think it's appropriate to seriously assess our lives and make some adjustments. I don't know what adjustments any individual person might want to make, but make some adjustments. If a person is motivated really powerfully and centrally in their life for the kind of a release and awakening and love and compassion that comes with a serious spiritual life. One of the wonderful aspects of concentration is that most of us in our fragmented concerns will often put a lot of energy, a lot of concentration into our preoccupations. We might have many preoccupations we're concerned about. And as we begin to develop concentration on something wholesome like the breath, we begin taking that absorption or that energy or that concentration that's in our fears and our anxieties and all that, and pulling it and focusing on something healthy, then we get a different perspective on our preoccupations. And part of the wonderful delight of getting concentrated is to be able to have this new perspective on our normal life. The example I gave some months ago on Thursday was, it's kind of like we're in a maze, lost in a maze. And the maze is just, the walls are just a little bit higher than our eyebrows. And we can't see out. And we're kind of lost in this maze, kind of, you know, bumping into walls and dead ends, and can't find our way out, and we get more afraid and more preoccupied, and, you know, feeling trapped, and we can't just, you know, want to escape out of this maze, which seems so difficult. And if that person who's in that maze stands up on his or her toes, because the walls are so low, they can see over the walls, and they maybe easily see the route that's the way out of the maze. Developing concentration is like that. It's kind of like the metaphoric toes that help us get a new perspective on our life that's very different than the perspective we have when we're in the middle of our preoccupations. And it's very hard when we're in the middle of our preoccupations to believe there's any other perspective that's valid. But if you develop your ability to get quiet and calm and concentrated, then you can use that concentration to actually get a whole new perspective on what's going on with us. And in that new perspective, have a whole different relationship to our preoccupations. Maybe not see them as such a big deal. You might see, sometimes we see solutions that we didn't see before. Sometimes we might see that maybe it wasn't such a big problem to begin with. More profoundly, what we might realize is that maybe we're fundamentally okay, fundamentally whole, fundamentally whole is a good word, even with our problem. That we don't have to fix our problem in order to feel good about ourselves. Isn't that great? And many of us are fixated on our problems and feel, oh, if I fix this particular problem, then I'll be okay. But the wonderful thing that can happen with a strong concentration is if we pull ourselves out of that, and we can have an experience of ourselves which feels whole, and from that perspective we feel, oh, I can be whole even having that problem. Isn't that good? I think that's good. Especially, I think, for many of us who tend to think that the only solution is to fix our problems. From a Buddhist perspective, if you're going to try to fix your problems, you'll never be done. I mean, not to say that certain things shouldn't be addressed. The whole point of the first five steps, you know, leading up to concentration, is you really need to take seriously your conditions in your life and your difficulties and work in them and really try to clarify them in the many ways that we can. But it's a dead end if you think that you're going to solve all your problems. And sooner or later, you have to, you know, it's helpful to kind of have an experience of yourself which you feel that it's possible to be whole even with your problems. So the problems don't become the problems anymore. So then they're not problems anymore, but hopefully that made sense. So concentration is a really, really important part of practice. And it's something which doesn't come easily, but it's something which needs to be nurtured. And something that, if we have appreciation for the value of concentration, it's a lot easier to develop it. And in developing concentration, almost everyone I know will have to learn through trial and error. We'll have to learn through some struggle and some difficulty, because we'll inevitably take some awkward relationship to developing concentration. We'll strive too hard, we'll huff and puff too much, or it becomes a willful thing, or then maybe we become too complacent, and we just say, well, guilt is just a gift, it just happens on its own, so I just go, you know, I think I'll just spend the day at the beach and do crossword puzzles and see what happens. Or whatever, you know, it's too complacent. So there's a whole art to learning what it takes. It's an art. I think of a wonderful, it's a wonderful word. It's an art, a skill like an art, where you have to try and try in ways that doesn't work for a while, and try to find your own way, trial and error. What helps and supports you to become settled on yourself, relaxed on yourself enough so that the mind can get settled and enter into samadhi. This mind can settle and enter into a great stability where the body feels really stable in the present moment, the mind feels stable, the feelings, everything feels tremendous stability and focus and quietness, stillness. And from that stability, from that stillness, we have the ability to see really clearly. Samadhi or concentration is considered in Buddhism to be a means. It's not a goal. And some people take it as a goal and end up kind of shortchanging themselves. Concentration is a means to help us see clearly. And when we have the mind stable enough in the present moment, and the mind is no longer kind of caught up in its, you know, normal preoccupations, then there's a clarity of seeing that we can see into the present moment, into the way things are, which is a very important term in Buddhism, to see things as they are. And the seventh step in these 12 steps I'm covering during these talks is the knowledge and vision of how things are. It's the knowledge and the seeing into how things actually are, which is supported by the ability to get concentrated. And that's a topic for the next time I come and talk on Sunday. I'd like to say a couple of other things. That the level of concentration we need, that we're talking about here, to see clearly, is not that great. There are phenomenal stories in the Buddhist tradition of great feats of concentration. Someone came to me yesterday and talked about her Chinese Chan master talked about someone who entered in meditation and I guess didn't move or do anything for 30 days. And people thought that he was dead. Because, you know, usually if you don't move or eat or go to the bathroom for 30 days, you know. And so then they went over and rang a bell next to him, and then he woke up out of his meditation. And then, you know, I never heard 30 days, but in Thailand it's quite common, not quite, but there's lots of stories of people going for 7 days and 7 nights, just entering very deep states of absorption. So these wonderful stories of great adepts in meditation have these abilities. For the purposes, there is usefulness for these kinds of experience, but for the purposes of mindfulness practice and the clear seeing of mindfulness, you don't have to develop your concentration to that level. I don't know how it is for most people, but I don't know if this is a useful analogy, but the level of concentration that I attained taking the written exam from the DMV is an adequate amount. Now maybe I have a tendency sometimes of getting more concentrated than maybe some people, but I used to love taking exams in college because I'd get concentrated. I'd leave, you know, because fear and anxiety wasn't part of the exam taking, would be before. But once I was there, I was totally involved just taking the exam. And I remember leaving the exams, and I used to love taking exams, especially because when I left in the room, I'd go out and just look around, and everything was so still and so sparkling and so special, and I felt so, you know, I didn't always do good in my exams, but I felt so good because of what happened with concentration. So, you know, the concentration doesn't have to be that powerful to see clearly. The other thing to say is that concentration is not easy for many people to develop. Some people have a natural gift for it, but I don't think I have a gift for it, even though maybe it seems to indicate that just now. It was very difficult for me to develop concentration in my longer retreats. It took a long time. However, honesty and what we learn about ourselves and what we confront and deal with and resolve in ourselves in order to get to a point of getting concentrated is phenomenally useful spiritual work. So rather than being discouraged that you can't get concentrated, a very important part of mindfulness practice is to be very honest about what it is that keeps you from getting concentrated. What are the barriers for getting settled in the present moment? And really addressing those in a very honest and direct way. And that's a really important part of the spiritual life. So rather than being discouraged that you're not getting concentrated yet in some powerful way, just appreciate the fact you're doing really important work. Learning about yourself and bringing mindfulness to all these different parts of your life that keep you from being concentrated. I've seen people who have a natural ability to get deeply concentrated, who enter in deep states of concentration, deep states of transformation even, but they've never really, because they had some natural ability to have a shortcut to states of concentration, they never really resolved some of the neurotic tendencies of their mind, of their life. And so they come out of these deep retreats, and sooner or later they have to deal with all these unfinished business. So you either take care of the unfinished business before you get concentrated, or you can do it after your concentrated periods, or you do it before and after, or you do it all the time. But don't be discouraged if concentration is not easy for you. But I hope that you also have a greater appreciation based on today's talk on the to claim. Are you ready for this? Maybe you don't want to hear this. To claim that the joy, the physical joy and delight that can come from deep states of concentration are more pleasurable and more delightful, more satisfying than any sexual pleasure you can have. Now, what do you think of that?
Does that qualify as a sense pleasure?
It's usually they don't call it a sense pleasure, and that it's not. It's. I don't quite understand the distinction here, but I think the ancient Buddhists had a different understanding of senses than we do. For them, it was the six senses. You know, touch, taste, smell, touch. As I said, smell, hearing, and all these the five sense doors and the mind door. But the pleasures that kind of well up from inside the body, not from touching anything. Is considered to be a non-sensual pleasure. It doesn't arise out of the contact with something, and so that's non-sensual. It's non-contact. In our world, we might call it sensual pleasure because it involves the body. Make sense? Yeah. Please.
So does concentration lead to insight?
It doesn't have to lead to insight. But the concentration is a condition that supports the possibility of deep insight. It's possible to develop too much concentration for the purposes of insight. And in that sense, just the path of concentration by itself is a dead end. And some people will kind of dead end, and then sometimes occasionally they'll need a good teacher who kind of helps them out of that dead end of concentration and into the world of insight and mindfulness. When I was practicing in Asia on these long retreats I sat, I had two different teachers, a Zen teacher and a Vipassana teacher, tell me at a certain point that I had to let go of concentration. And I didn't have a clue how. It was very hard. But so it's possible to develop too much concentration, and it's important to be able to let go of it. Nancy?
I just want to call you to follow up on the statement you just made about those accounts. Did they go one step further and describe that experience as akin to orgasmic energy?
Occasionally I've heard that description. I don't use the word orgasmic energy, but it's sometimes. I've had people tell me they feel like they're having an orgasm.
Right.
Just the tremendous waves of rapture that seem to flow through the body.
Right.
That comes with meditation. Waves of rapture?
Without all
this. Yeah. Tell me how. What?
Yeah.
What?
I stopped meditating because I experienced that and I thought it was weird. Because I didn't have a teacher who could.
I see. Not everyone. Some people, it's easier than other people to have that in meditation. And some people will never have great rapture in meditation and they don't need to. Some people have it, and if it happens too easily sometimes without the proper guidance, it can be eventually it can get discouraging. But one of the things that, for people who follow the path of concentration, one of the fascinating things that happens is that at a certain point, they'll develop certain levels of rapture. And then after having had enough rapture, they realize that it's actually unpleasant. And they don't want any more of it. And then they have to learn how to let go of the rapture in order to take something which is a little bit more sublime kind of concentration. And they usually, then rather than being this physical rapture, it becomes more of a, it can be more of a sense of a tremendous happiness, which is much more sublime and quieter. And then after a while, you have to realize there's something unpleasant and unsatisfactory about that happiness also. After you've had enough of it, you're full of it. Perhaps. And then you have to be trained to let go of the happiness to something more sublime. Equanimity. So, my teacher in Burma, Pandita, he never taught, he very seldom taught people concentration practice. He actually discouraged people from doing it for the most part. But if someone came to him to study with him who had been doing a lot of concentration practice, he was always delighted because he felt that they had a good foundation then. It's like the mind has been conditioned and it's ready to, you can use that strength of concentration for the insight practice. So concentration is like a muscle and you can develop this muscle. It's like going to a gym, you go to the gym, and if you go to the gym, once every 2 years, you're not going to get very strong. But if you go to the gym every day, eventually you build up some strong muscles. So you can take that kind of very matter-of-fact, kind of mundane approach to concentration. If you just kind of cultivate it and develop it every day, you can develop concentration. And then that strength of mind, that strength of concentration, is very supportive of insight practice. So in your situation, one way is for you to actually go back into those states that you've experienced of rapture in your body, and then use that as a foundation to do the insight practice, rather than avoiding it entirely. Last one, then we'll stop.
Did you find that you can concentrate on your intentions by your nature? Can
you
use that mentally in your meditation to go through the mental process of, for instance, playing a piece to get yourself in? Is that considered like using
a crack to get concentrated? Well, maybe I'm not going to answer you directly right away. I've met musicians who have great ability to get concentrated and have attributed their ability for concentration to having spent a lifetime playing musical instruments, like professional musicians, because they're so concentrated in the present moment, and it really helps. So you're strengthening that muscle. So when you, I've also had heard computer programmers say the same thing. Mm-hmm. They develop a lot of concentration in front of a computer terminal, and then that muscle has been strengthened, and when they go to meditate, that muscle is ready to be used. But I think your question is, can I play my musical instrument first and then go meditate?
No, bring that piece that I'm working on into my meditation mentally.
Oh, mentally.
And then just concentrate on the notes mentally and then get concentrated kind of vicariously.
Well, everything's permitted, you know. There's one of the classic ways of doing Buddhist practice is to first do a concentration practice, and there's many concentration practices, and maybe yours is a new one, you know, a nice one, you know, just do it. And then once your mind is concentrated, then switching over to mindfulness practice. That's the classic way of practicing. In the tradition that I was trained in Asia, there was a strong tendency, which I kind of carry with me still, maybe it's not a useful one, but to focus on mindfulness purely and not to rely on anything else outside. So just to develop whatever concentration you need while the person is doing mindfulness, not to develop concentration separately. And so I'm a little bit of a purist around that, and you should always be careful when you're around purists. So yes, it's fine to do, you know, and you might experiment with it for a while and see if it helps you, and then we'll talk about it some more. So I hope that this was interesting and useful, and to talk about concentration and I'll come back and give a talk in, I guess, in 3 weeks, and then we'll talk about how things are.